Welcome to this Uvula audio presentation of The Lone Ranger Rides by Fran Stryker. I'm your narrator, Jim Campanella. Late in 1932, Fran Stryker began working on the radio play version of The Lone Ranger. His earliest scripts were largely reworked from his earlier series, Covered Wagon Days. A letter from WXYZ station owner George Trendle, dated Monday, January 30th, 1933, clearly gives Stryker credit for creating the character. However, by 1934, Stryker was pressured by Trendle to sign over his rights to the Lone Ranger, and Trendle claimed credit as a creator. This sparked a long-term controversy over the creation of the Lone Ranger, extending to as recently as 1960. Stryker wrote this first Lone Ranger novel in 1936 as the beginning of an 18-volume series for Grosset and Dunlap. The novel tells of the Ranger's mythic origins as a crime fighter. Some people have deemed it a classic of Western literature. A posse of six members of the Texas Ranger Division are ambushed by a band of outlaws led by Bartholomew Butch Cavendish. Later, an Indian named Tonto stumbles upon the scene and recognizes the lone survivor, Ranger Reed, whose first name was never given on the show, as the man who had saved his life sometime in the past. He nurses Reed back to health. The two men dig six graves for Reed and his comrades, so that Cavendish will believe that there were no survivors. And that is pretty much the beginning of Stryker's story. Much like the other so-called Boy Scouts, Superman and Doc Savage, the Lone Ranger conducted himself by a strict moral code put in place by Stryker at the inception of the character. It reads as follows. I believe that to have a friend, a man must be one, that all men are created equal, and that everyone has within himself the power to make this a better world, that God put the firewood there, but that every man must gather and light it himself. In being prepared physically, mentally, and morally to fight when necessary for that which is right, that a man should make the most of what equipment he has, that this government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall live always, that men should live by the rule of what is best for the greatest number, that sooner or later, somewhere, somehow, we must settle with the world and make payment for what we have taken, that all things change but truth, and that truth alone lives on forever, in my Creator, my country, and in my fellow man. And now, The Lone Ranger Rides. Chapter 1. The Basin. In a remote basin in the western part of Texas, the Cavendish clan raised cattle. From the vast, level acreage where longhorns grew fat on lush grass, the surrounding hills looked verdant and hospitable. But this was pure deceit on nature's part. Those hills were treacherous, and Bryant Cavendish loved them for that self-same treachery. Sitting on the porch of his rambling house, the bitter old man spat tobacco-flavored curses at the infirmities that restricted him. His legs, tortured by rheumatism, were propped on a bent wood chair and seemed slim and out of proportion to his barrel-shaped torso. His eyes, like caves beneath an overhanging ledge, were more restless than usual as he gazed across the basin. He rasped a heavy thumbnail across the bristle of his slab-like jowl. There was something in the air he couldn't explain. He felt a vague uneasiness despite the almost pastoral scene before him. He scanned the hills on all sides of the basin, knowing that no stranger could come through the tangle of underbrush and dense forest. Those hills had always been practically impassable. Then his restless eyes fell on the weird riot of color to the north. That was Bryant's Gap. Water flowing from the basin springs had patiently, through countless ages, cut the deep cleft in solid rock. The walls towering high on each side reflected unbelievable hues. Bryant's scowl deepened as he observed the gap. He could see but a few yards into it, and then it turned, and his view ended abruptly on a rainbow wall. That wall often reminded Cavendish of a rattler, beautiful but dangerous.
"It was only straight," he'd growl. "I could see when someone comes this way, but the damn canyon is as fickle as a wench's disposition."
Once more his fingers scraped across the 2-day beard. Cavendish had survived a good many years there in the West. He had risen above the many forms of sudden death to know an old age of comparative security. But like men in that region where eternal vigilance was the price of safety, his intuition was developed to a high degree. In a poker game, he played his hunches, but in life he listened to that little-understood sixth sense.
"Something," he decided, "is going on in that gap, sure as I'm a-sitting here."
As if to echo his words, a distant rumble reached his ears. It came from the gap. At first he thought it must be another one of the frequent storms. He listened. Then his face grew harder than before, and his jaw set firmly.
"That ain't no thunder," he muttered. "That's gunplay."
His first impulse was to call for some of his men to investigate. Instead, he listened for a moment. His niece Penelope could be heard humming a gay tune inside the house. She, at least, had not heard anything unusual. Bryant knew his eyes were failing him of late, and he began to doubt his ears, too, now. Perhaps, after all, it might have been thunder. Wouldn't do to start a commotion over nothing at all. Mustn't let the boys know how the old man was slipping. He struggled to his feet, and half-supporting his weight by gripping the back of the chair, moved to the end of the porch, and looked toward the south, where two of his nephews stood idly smoking near a corral. His lips moved with unuttered comments when he saw the men. Scowling, he made his painful way back to the chair.
"Must have been mistaken," he muttered.
There was no proof that Brian Cavendish did not like his relatives. On the other hand, he had never shown affection for them. That wasn't unusual, because he never had cared particularly about anyone. His bitter outlook on life made him feel that affection and softness went hand in hand. He had lost all respect for his two brothers when they married. The fact that Bryant had outlived them both proved to his own satisfaction, which was all that mattered, that marriage and the problems of the Benedict make men die young. One brother had left 4 sons, the other a daughter. Bryant, the last of his generation, had raised the brood. His domination cowed the boys, but Penelope escaped. An inherent sense of humor saved the girl. When Penny left for an eastern school, in accordance with the written will of her foresighted father, she was without a trace of the sullen, subservient manner that marked her cousins. Brian frowned on the idea of sending the girl to school. To him it seemed like a waste of time and money, but he followed the terms of his brother's will with meticulous care. Superlatives cannot be used in connection with the boys of the second generation of Cavendishes, so instead of stating that Mort was the most courageous, it is more accurate to record that Jeb, Vince, and Wally were even less courageous than Mort. It was Mort who, as a pimpled adolescent, suggested meekly that he and his brothers leave the basin. It took 3 days for the flames of rage that exploded from Bryant Cavendish to die down, and their embers smoldered for weeks after that. It took several years for Mort to build up the spunk to assert himself again. He married Rebecca and brought her to the basin. The hurricane blasts from Uncle Bryant made all previous Cavendish tirades seem like the babblings of brooks that inspire poets. Bryant was an old man, and even his iron will could no longer ignore the rheumatism that made his legs almost useless. As it became increasingly necessary for the nephews to assume responsibility, his resentment toward them grew proportionately. Cool water piped from a mountain spring gurgled and splashed into a trough, a sheltered basin blanketed with grass, sturdy, comfortable houses, contented cattle growing fat, the song of a girl, the laughter of a child, clumping hooves, lazy smoke from cowboy cigarettes. "You got the makings? Ain't Mort's wife starting to get big again?"
"I heard a doggone funny story last week. It'll all bust your sides. Give me that length of chaw, will you?"
"My feet are killing me."
"I gotta get me some boots next payday. Thunderstorm is coming tomorrow."
In the basin, it was all normalcy. But in Bryant's Gap, majestic in height, gorgeous in color, like the rattlesnake, 6 men sprawled on rock-strewn ground, and the buzzards circled overhead. Chapter 2. The Gap.
The lifeless forms that littered the floor of Bryant's Gap had but recently been men who lived a vital, hard life in the outdoors. Men who could shoot fast and straight, whose every sense was tuned to a pitch that made them aware of any danger that lurked. The dead men had been Texas Rangers. In a roundabout way, these riders had been told that men they sought as outlaws could be found in Bryant's Basin. To reach the basin, they had ridden through the Gap, almost through the Gap, but death had cut their journey short. Killers, waiting behind protecting rocks, had fired without warning. Half of the small band had spilled from the saddle, either dead or wounded, at the first fusillade of bullets. The others, with the intuitive action of men who live and often die by the gun, had leapt to the ground to fight from behind the scant protection of fallen horses. Empty cartridge cases gave mute evidence of their gallant stand. The Rangers all had fallen, but in one, a tiny spark of life still glowed. The man, wounded in several places, looked dead. Even the buzzards, circling ever lower, experts at recognizing death, were deceived. The gaunt bird seemed to dart away in surprise when the lone survivor moved. A dazed sort of consciousness came slowly to him. At first he was aware of heat. Heat from the sun overhead and the rocks surrounding him. Then the heat became a frightful burning, concentrated in his right leg and left shoulder. Blood seeping from a gash across his forehead blinded him. He tried to move, but the effort made him giddy. He fell back to rest while he fought to gather his scattered senses. As the mists lifted from his mind, he remembered sudden shots, his comrades falling, stabbing pain shooting through his left side from the shoulder down, his left hand useless, a bullet in his foot, falling to the ground, oblivion. Ambush, treachery. He had to live. He had to bring the killers in. Sheer courage and the will to ignore the pain that racked his entire body brought the wounded man to a sitting position. At the time, the thought that murderers might still be lurking close at hand did not occur to him. His first thought was to see if any of the others needed help, but when he tried to rise, he was amazed at his own weakness. He realized that he was beyond the point of helping others. He could barely move. He wiped the blood from his eyes, but his vision was fogged. Only large objects could be discerned, and those not clearly. He tried to locate the horses, but all except his own had died or disappeared. The white stallion that he himself had ridden stood a short distance away, as if waiting for the next command of its master. He tried to give the familiar whistle, but no sound issued from his dry, bloodless lips. He called to the horse, and his own voice startled him. It was an unfamiliar voice, one that he had never heard before, almost a croaking voice. But the stallion heard it and came obediently to the side of the sitting man. The big horse lowered its head at a whispered command. The reins fell close to the hands of the man on the ground. He clutched for them and had to grope before he found them. Then, clinging to the bridle, he finally gained an unsteady footing. With the instinct of the hunted, he sought for his means of defense. His right hand fumbled at his waist for the familiar cartridge belt and the brace of heavy guns. The belt was missing. This discovery should have been cause for alarm, but in his desperate condition, the loss of the weapons seemed of small consequence to the Texas Ranger. He did, however, wonder vaguely where it had gone. He couldn't remember taking off the belt, but there were many details of the short battle that had escaped his recollection. He felt about his waist once more before he would believe that his weapons were not in their familiar place. Convinced then, he knew but one hope remained. Flight. Sensing that his master was in difficulty, knowing that something unusual had taken place, the big horse stood motionless while the ranger dragged his body to the saddle. It called for an almost superhuman effort to mount the horse. He made no attempt to sit erect. Instead, he leaned far forward, fighting desperately against the constantly increasing nausea that threatened to deprive him of consciousness. He nudged the horse with one heel, and Silver trotted forward. Direction was a thing far out of the question, and the rider made no effort to guide his horse. He clung to the saddle, fighting every moment of the time to stay alive, while the horse carried him from the scene of sudden death, where buzzards circled lower, ever lower. When he could gather the strength to speak, he whispered in a husky voice, close to the ear of the horse.
Away, Silver. Away.
A trail of red that continually dripped from his right boot warned the Texas Ranger that he must stop soon and try to make some sort of inventory of his condition. But he can inventory nothing. He could remember next to nothing. He could not see 50 feet ahead or behind. He knew, however, that the wound in his right foot was the one most in need of attention. He managed to examine this without slackening his speed. The sight inside his blood-soaked boot was anything but reassuring. He rode on, sparing neither his horse nor his own condition. Spells of dizziness, recurring with increasing frequency, made him realize that he could not continue much further without staunching the flow of blood from the boot. He pulled the white horse to a halt and slid to the ground. With relief, he found that his vision had improved, and he could scan the gap behind him. There was no sign of pursuit. He cut open the boot and found that a bullet had severed a small artery. Making a rude tourniquet, he succeeded in checking, to some extent, the spurting flow that was sapping his strength. He bandaged the wound as best he could with dressings torn from his shirt. He tried to stand and found that the loss of so much blood had sapped his strength to a surprising degree. He could, however, support his weight by the aid of his horse. His mind was clearer. He found himself trying to analyze the events that had led up to the massacre, while his eyes studied the gap. Why had the Texas Rangers been sent for? If they were not wanted in Bryan's Basin, it would have been a simple matter to ignore them, as had always been done in the past. Someone had sent for the Texas Rangers. Someone had objected with bullets to their coming. Did outlaws actually live in Bryan's Basin? If so, why were they there? Why had the Rangers been sent for? What could possibly happen in the Cavendish domain that the stern old man could not handle himself? These and countless other questions raced through the Ranger's brain while he continued to observe the gap. He noted that the sun was gone and it was growing dark. This left him in less danger of capture, but increased the difficulty of the ride. The rocky footing was hazardous under the best of conditions. In the dark, this peril was increased tenfold. He remounted after a struggle with weakness. At first, he tried to guide the horse away from Bryant's Basin, but this seemed only to confuse the beast, so he gave up the attempt and let Silver have his head. At intervals, he was compelled to steady himself like a drunken man. A starless night fell into the gap, and with its coming, the danger of pursuit was ended. A chance encounter was all the rider had to fear, and there was little likelihood of that. For a while, his mind went blank. He was roused from a sort of stupor by the sound of running water. The horse had halted while the Texas Ranger dozed, and was drinking from a creek. A sudden, uncontrollable thirst assailed the man. Once more, he climbed painfully from the saddle. Slumping to the ground, he crawled toward a stream that gurgled over stones. Cold water had never tasted sweeter. He sipped slowly, then raised his head to let the cool draft quench the burning in his throat. About to drink again, he paused and grew tense. The sound he heard might have been a night bird, but the trained ear of the ranger detected a peculiar quality to it. Odd, he thought. That sounded as if it came from a human throat. He waited to catch the next call, if it were repeated. He didn't see that Silver, too, was tense. The bird-like trill sounded again, nearer this time. The horse reacted unexpectedly to the call. Silver jerked back, and the reins slipped from the wounded man's hand. While he watched in consternation, the white horse scampered off in the direction of the sound. Stunned by this new misfortune, the wounded man listened to the hoofbeats until they were swallowed by the night. Not until then did he try to call. His voice was barely a whisper. Desertion by Silver was the worst possible thing that could have happened. Pursuit of the horse was out of the question. The wounded man couldn't even stand alone. With such philosophy as he could muster, he turned and finished the drink that might cost him his life. Then he dashed water over his face, which had become caked with blood, sweat, and alkali dust. The wound on his forehead was a minor one, but it smarted frightfully as the water touched it. He determined to make himself as comfortable as possible while he had the opportunity and plenty of water. He turned his attention to his other wounds. Removing his shirt, he felt gingerly on his left shoulder. His left arm had been useless to him, and now he knew why. The bullet was embedded in the flesh. He realized that this might cause considerable trouble later on, but there was little that he could do in the darkness, other than wash the wound and bandage it clumsily. The bullet was sunk deeply, probably to the bone. He rightly reasoned that some of the force had been lost by the bullet's first striking a rock and entering his arm on a ricochet. Otherwise, the bone would have been broken. His shoulder fixed to the best of his ability, he looked at his wounded foot again. It was difficult to determine much about the wound in the darkness, but the bleeding seemed to have stopped. When he had bathed and redressed the foot, he found that he could stand. He had to support himself by clinging to a rock. Most of his weight was taken on the uninjured leg, but he was definitely stronger. One thought remained uppermost in the Texas Ranger's mind.
I have to live, he breathed. I have to fight through somehow, so I can tell what happened to the others. Come back with more men. Learn what's going on in Cavendish's place.
If he could stay in the stream, he'd leave no trail. He started slowly, working his way along the current, clinging to the rocks when they were within reach, crawling on his stomach when his wounded leg gave out. Frequently, he paused to rest, still remaining in the stream. He was soaked through, but the cold water was pleasant. It chilled the burning of his wounds and made the pain more tolerable. The stream took him close to one wall of the canyon, the wall on his left. Against the current, his progress was painfully slow, but it was progress. Somewhere in the darkness ahead, he heard the sound of falling water. This animated him. A falls might mean some sort of gorge. A tiny cave, perhaps, in which a man might hide until his wounds were healed. By resting frequently, the wounded man kept going longer than he thought possible. At length, he reached the falls. The water dropped a scant 4 feet from a ledge. With his one good hand, the wounded ranger pulled himself up on the ledge, and there his strength abandoned him. He slumped, half in the stream, half out of it, and sank, completely spent, into a dense void of unconsciousness. Chapter 3. The Cave. When he awakened, the wounded Texas Ranger realized that it was well past daybreak. The sun was high in the cloudless sky and beating down on the ledge. It must have been the sun, shining directly into the man's eyes, that had roused him. When he moved, he felt a new tormented pain in every fiber of his being. His wounds had stiffened. His right foot and leg and left shoulder and arm were utterly useless. Movement of these limbs made stabbing pain shoot through the entire length of his body. He lay quietly for some time, experimenting with the slightest movements, until he managed to turn so he could look about him. The ledge that had served as a resting place at night was a dangerous refuge in the daytime. A discovery buoyed his hope. He saw that the water came from an opening a few yards back on the ledge. The opening was large enough for a man to enter standing up, with room to spare. Inside, he would be sure of concealment and a plentiful supply of water. Unless someone actually entered the cave, he would be comparatively secure. His only considerations would be hunger, weakness, and complications that might set in from the wounds. Food would be the big problem. Even with a good horse, it would take more riding than he could do in his present state to reach the nearest food. Without weapons of any sort, he could scarcely hunt, even if there were game to be found in the barren, sun-baked gap. Food, therefore, was out of the question. He had to content himself with water until he was strong enough to travel far on foot. He crawled painfully toward the cave and stopped just beyond the entrance. Inside, it widened out surprisingly. Torrents of water in some ages past must have churned furiously, seeking exit through the portal to carve away the heavy stone in such a manner. The stream came from somewhere in the deep, dim recesses of the cave. Gravel and shale lined the water's edge. This hard ground would serve the Texas Ranger as a rough couch, perhaps for many days to come. The outlook was desperate, yet the man felt that there must be some reason why his life had been spared thus far. It wasn't that he was afraid to die. At any time during the past few hours, death would have been a welcome relief to the pain of living. Some voice deep inside him, though, kept telling him that he had to live, had to fight for life so that he might see justice done. And so he fought on. None of the events seemed logical to him, yet he sensed that in some manner everything would dovetail into a finished pattern in which he himself would play a prominent part. Every element of his life during the past day and night had been a new experience. Even the gap in the cave were new to him. Strange, random thoughts kept intruding on his efforts to make plans for the future. Thoughts of his life in the past, the silver mine inherited from his father, but never worked because he had never wanted riches. He was tired despite the recent sleep. He lay back, right hand behind his head. Perhaps he dozed. He couldn't tell afterwards whether he had slept or not. His senses played such pranks that his thoughts might have been dreams or mere hallucinations. At any rate, those thoughts were vivid and oddly assorted. Against the roaring background of the water in the cavern, he seemed to hear a voice. First, it was the voice of a boy, an Indian boy whom the wounded man had known long years ago. He too had been a boy at that time. The Indian was alone, a child who was the sole survivor of a furious Indian war. The son of a chief, the lad had remained sorely wounded at the side of his dead parents. It was there that the white boy had found him and took him as a friend. The two traveled together for some time until their trails separated. Now he heard the voice of this boy again. Against the blackness of the cavern's depths, he seemed to see a reenactment of the past in rapidly changing kaleidoscopic scenes. He saw himself as a hunter, riding in pursuit of bison, to feed the starving white folks in a village and Indians on the plains. He saw himself riding through the hills in preference to gathering wealth as the operator of a silver mine, and then a reunion with the Indian he'd known as a boy. Together the two rode for a time, and Tonto, the Indian, helped the ranger capture his white horse. The day he joined the Texas Rangers was a vivid recollection. His pride in wearing the ranger badge was tempered by the loss of Tonto's companionship. Somewhere in the background of his visions, there was a vague memory of a nightbird's call. He wondered at the scenes in a detached sort of way. Was this what dying was like? He'd heard that one's past went by in review as a man's soul departed. He no longer felt the wounds. The rumbling stream became a distant murmur that finally resolved itself into the call of a nightbird. Odd how that nightbird's call continued to intrude. He fumbled with his right hand in the pocket of what was left of his shirt. He could feel the small, square object there and wished that he had the strength to take it out. He would have liked to read the little inscription in the book that had been his mother's gift. Now even the last of sounds had ceased, and once more the tall man slept. His breathing was labored, and his hand upon his breast rose and fell as fingers that had been so strong and capable clutched the little black book in his pocket. The afternoon was well advanced. The sun barely peeped over the rim of the gap, but the last rays slanted at an acute angle beyond the mouth of the cave and brushed the shoulder of the sleeping man. He wakened in surprise. He felt himself surrounded by almost unbearable heat. His mouth was dry, his throat burning with thirst again. He was barely able to raise one arm to brush a hand across his forehead. He found that forehead dry and hot. He felt giddy. His mind whirled as he tried to comprehend this new condition. He must have tossed restlessly while he slept. His shirt was more ragged than ever. One pocket was ripped entirely off, and the little black book that had reposed there was beside him where it must have fallen from his hand. He felt his shoulder, wondering vaguely at the neatness of a bandage. He knew from the ugly swelling that the wound had become infected. Against the weakness there was only water and rest, and he already found that rest seemed only to weaken him further. His plight was critical. Water might help. It was all that he had. He rolled over painfully and stretched his length, face down against the stream. It was then that he saw the shadow. No sound had reached his ears above the water's clamor, but someone had found his hideout, and at that moment stood at the cavern's mouth. His first impulse was to turn quickly. He started to reach for his guns, forgetting that they were not in their usual places. Then he remembered that he was unarmed, completely at the mercy of whoever stood behind him. For a brief instant he felt an odd prickling sensation move along his spine. He inwardly shrank from the impact of the bullet he was sure would come at any instant. He felt that all he had to do was turn, face the man or men who had already killed his five companions, and his life too would be snuffed out. But did it matter? His life at best was measured in hours. Starvation, fever, and infection of an ugly wound were all potential killers. It was simply a case of which of these would deliver the coup de grace. His endurance and strength had carried him far beyond the limits of most men, but his own far limit had almost been reached. He had a revulsion to a bullet in the back, but after all, it didn't matter greatly. This intruder, he thought, is a friend, not an enemy. A friend, perhaps unwittingly, who would put an end to his pain. The man at the entrance watched in silence, and as the dying man turned, saw his face suffused with the glow of fever and etched with pain. He saw the glazed eyes that had been once so steely and deep, saw them rise slowly to meet his own dark, deep-set eyes. The wounded man looked up and met the gaze of an Indian. His lips parted slightly. His first attempt at speech was failure. Then he breathed the name of the friend he'd made long years before.
Tonto.
The Indian nodded slowly.
I'm here.